We'll put a little spice into romance today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Francesca Hawley is an author who gives us romance with dangerous curves. We'll meet her today on Scribble. That's a provocative opening, I must say. How are you, Francesca?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me today, Don.
Oh, our pleasure. How did you happen to get into writing romance novels?
I'd always read romances. I was a big fan of them as a teenager and into my 20s. And for the longest time, I didn't think I could ever write them. But I started reading romances, and so many of them, the authors would describe the heroines as having waists so tiny that you could span them with a man could span them with his hands. And I kept thinking, well, where are the big girls? You know, the curvy heroines. And so, and I am an unapologetic fat chick. So, for me, I started thinking, well, I love reading these. Why can't I write a heroine who's like me? So that's kind of what got me started.
So you're not only writing romances, you're making a statement.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I think that's interesting that, you know, it's true. When we look at works of art or literature, quite often you think, where am I in this?
Mm-hmm. That's very true.
And, you know, those of us like myself are pretty ordinary people are present in some sense in almost all books. Mm-hmm. But it's true. If you are not the so-called American ideal of weighing 98 pounds or something, then where are you in those?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like fashion clothing.
Yes.
Fashion clothing is the big thing. I look at those and I think, well, that's nice, but who could wear it?
Yeah. Right. And you find that to be true on romance book covers too. I've had a heck of a time getting covers where the hero and heroine, you know, there's a plus size heroine in the story, but all the cover art represents somebody who is very lovely but very slender. And so it has no representation of the character that's in the book. That's been challenging since I've been self-publishing.
Uh-huh. So. Well, I would imagine you'd find an audience, though.
I have found an audience, and I think many folks enjoy seeing themselves in stories and kind of cheer when the big girl gets the guy, and the overarching storyline isn't you have to lose weight to fall in love and have love. Mm-hmm. It's, well, you're big, so what?
Run out of time, mm-hmm, at the end, getting carried away with talking about romances. How can we get a hold of your books?
Most of them are available through Amazon.com. And you can look at my website, www.francescahawley.com, and that's spelled FRANCESCAHAWLEY.
Okay. Now, that's pretty specific. I can't talk anymore.
Well, Amazon is the source most people go to these days. Mm-hmm. So
that bothers me because I like local bookstores a lot. Mm-hmm. But there's not a lot of local bookstores to like.
Well, for one thing, the chances of getting a book published today and then into a bookstore is plus or minus 1%.
Yeah, it's very difficult. It's an incredibly competitive market. And while I appreciate that Amazon is out there and has made it so much easier for authors to publish themselves, I worry that they will get a monopoly on the market. And right now they're offering wonderful royalties to authors. But if they manage to corner a market on self-publishing, then they can decide, well, the author won't get that royalty anymore. We want more of the pie. And so the author royalties can go way down at their choosing.
Yeah, that's – the economics of writing is tough because
– It is.
So many authors have regular publishers, but they don't have regular income.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a problem.
You gave us a little teaser in the information you sent about yourself saying you would be interested in talking about some difficulties you've had with publishers. And
yeah.
I think some of our readers who are also interested in writing would be interested in how that went.
Yeah. I went with a small print publisher. And
went with means they accepted it? Or?
Well, I went to RWA, which is Romance Writers of America.
Okay.
I was a member, and I went to one of their conferences and pitched my story to this small press. And for the longest time, they were wonderful. But then they started having financial difficulties, and they quit paying their royalties to their authors. And it they were representing at least 800 authors.
Wow. Wow.
And all of us quit getting paid, or very few of us got paid. They were paying their money makers, but they weren't paying the rest of us. And we finally were able to get out of – most of us were able to get out of our contracts and get the rights to our books back. Because basically what you do when you sign a contract is you aren't giving – in most cases, you aren't giving your book away. You're giving the rights to publish your book away. Well, you're signing it so that you're getting paid. And in the cases of traditional publishers, that generally means you get an advance – and then you have to sell through, which means make your money back. And then you start getting royalties after you make your money back. But if you don't have a large print run, you may never make your money back and you may never get any royalties.
Hmm.
So it's complicated. And so what I would encourage anyone to do if they have the good fortune, they send something off to Simon & Schuster or St. Martin's or one of those big presses, and they receive a contract back. If you have an agent, and in most cases to go with a traditional publisher, you require one. They won't look at it without an agent. Then have your agent be, you know, perform due diligence and really negotiate well for you. And if you go with someplace, if you're a romance writer, Mills and Boone, which publishes Harlequin and Silhouette and those series, they have a boilerplate. So you want to make sure that you don't sign away things that you don't want to lose. Many of the early publisher or the early authors actually lost pen names because the pen name was included in the contract. Mm-hmm. So then they had to reestablish themselves all over if they wanted to write somewhere else. So you want to make sure if you aren't represented by an agent, you find someone who understands contract law, and particularly contract law as it applies to publishing, and have them at least vet that contract for you and do the initial negotiation and then use that same contract. And if anything changes, take it back to that lawyer. It can be expensive, but it's way more expensive if you lose your pen name. Because, you know, it was like, What's Love Got to Do with It, where Tina Turner said that one scene in the courtroom where she says, I want to keep my name, and because everybody knows who Tina Turner is. Nobody knows who, what's her real name, Anna, is. Mm-hmm. You know, they know who the name is. And so you want to keep that name. And she was willing to forego a whole lot of money to keep her name.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And it's I noticed that in reading Publishers and Editors Weekly,
mm-hmm.
they have a section on self-published books.
Yes.
because that's become such a big section of the whole field. It's not just the regular publishers, but the self-publishers. They have a page of the best-selling books.
Mm-hmm. Well, even many writers who have published with publishers have now come back to self-publishing because they have more control.
And you get a better royalty.
Or in your book. Yeah. Well, you do.
Well, and you can choose your own covers. Right. When you go with something with a traditional publisher, they decide what your cover looks like. And if they decide you don't get any say in your cover, you don't get any say in your cover if you've signed the contract that says that.
This is really interesting. But I'm also interested in your writing. Can you give us a sample of one of your books?
Yes. This is – I write paranormal romance that's contemporary. I also write historical romance, and I sometimes mix the two together. And I also write contemporary romance. That was also one of the issues with me, is that I'm somebody that writes all over the place. And generally, publishers want you to find a brand and stick with it. Well, my brand is plus-size heroines. It's not necessarily historical fiction or paranormal fiction. In this case, it's a combination of historical and paranormal. This is set in the Middle Ages. It's called Seeking Truth. It was published with my former publisher, but I received the rights back. And I haven't re-released it, but I'm working on additional books in the series so that I can re-release them as a group. Mm-hmm. And this is a scene where my heroine meets the hero. Lady Vérité de Savigny heard the pounding of hooves approach the outer gates of the abbey and the subsequent shouting. Such sounds were rare, so they occasioned notice. What was happening? Did someone need treatment? She wanted to look, but knew that to venture forth would bring down the wrath of Sister Berta on her head, so she remained in the safety of her garden. Seeing her herbs grow vigorously as the spring rains fed them was one of her few pleasures, and she hoarded those allowed her. She wished it was a slightly warmer day, but for May it was pleasant. She'd worked in the garden since just after the hour of prime, and would likely remain there the rest of the day despite the rain, except for the time she was called to prayer. Anything that allowed her respite from Sister Berta was to be blessed. The good sister, and Vérité used the term good very loosely, had been chastising her this morning after Terce, less than half an hour ago, for her ungodly behavior. Yet again, she'd made the mistake of responding, only God could be godly, so it would be presumptuous of her, Vérité, to aspire to such heights. Therefore, ungodly behavior was the best she could do. Her cheek still felt warm, smarting from the slap she'd received for her impertinence. Vérité glanced at the new novice who shared the garden with her. She couldn't understand why anyone would willingly immure herself in the cloister. She hated it here. Her only relief was the time she spent in her gardens. Vérité carefully weeded the herbs while desperately missing her friend Mistress Judith's cigar. It had been scarcely a month since Judith last visited to share dire news about her health. Judith had been both a link to the outside world and her mentor in the healing arts, never judging her or the magical talent she did her best to hide from others. Her friend accepted her, and it saddened Vérité to know the older woman was dying. Pressing her hands deeply into the dark soil, sudden chills spread over her, so she leaned back to scan the garden. Something was amiss. The air was tense with waiting, and the birds were eerily silent, yet nothing appeared awry. It was almost as if this were a pause before a storm. She attempted to will the feeling away, but it remained as strong as ever. Vérité sighed, rising to investigate. "Do you need aid, my lady?" Vérité turned to the earnest young novice, biting her lip. "Would you find Mother Anne and inquire if I'm needed? I would be glad to." The girl smiled gently, understanding Verite's reluctance to chance upon Sister Berta. She patted Verite's shoulder as she passed her on her way to the gate. Verite could feel the young maiden's pity from touch alone, even through her garments. How she wished she'd never inherited her mother's abilities. I'll stop there.
Okay, very good. That's an interesting picture you paint.
What makes something a romance?
generally a romance in whatever genre or subgenre is historically it was a man and a woman meeting, falling in love, and living happily ever after. Romances have changed so that the couple may now be a hero and a heroine, a hero and a heroine and a heroine, or any kind of combination thereof, as long as there's a committed relationship of some sort at the end. So it's happily ever after or happily for now.
Mm-hmm.
And but it's,
why does it have to be committed?
Because the idea is that you want to imagine that these people will work through whatever challenges they face in life and live out a good life together.
I think that, you know, the idea of commitment, everyone experiences infatuation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that instant you yes. know this is the person you want to be with as intimately as possible.
Yeah.
A commitment is something that would take you past that
mm-hmm.
because all infatuations fade and even stop. Well, what is there about this person that is worth staying with through
exactly.
all the rough patches that are ahead
mm-hmm.
that in an infatuation you cannot anticipate?
Right.
Yeah, so right. that's a... Let me define commitment for
you. Okay, well, you just... Do you think it would be possible to write a romance without sex?
Oh, absolutely. That's what they all used to be.
Well, the Harlequin romances are. I mean, they're. But that's like
exactly.
Catalan,
well,
right?
But think Barbara Cartland. Mm-hmm. The only thing that happened in a Barbara Cartland novel was maybe a kiss.
But I mean, these days.
These days, yes.
Well,
absolutely.
Your book's a little more specific.
Oh yeah, I classify when I'm talking about romances, and I think I said this in my email to you guys. I put them on a pepper scale, and it fits. You can write a bell pepper, but I tend to write jalapenos, habaneros, and even ghost peppers.
Ghost pepper got me because I grew those one year.
Yeah.
You do make me want to read some of the stuff you've written just to see what a ghost pepper level romance would be.
But, you know, you also can have, and many of the in the genre, in the industry, they refer to those as sweet romances. And they don't mean sweet just in terms of, oh, isn't that sweet? They mean no sex. Mm-hmm. There might be a kiss, and at the end there's commitment. Marriage might happen early in the story or late, but there's nothing – the door is closed.
Mm-hmm.
And if they are getting together, the reader never sees it. It's left entirely to the imagination in a sweet romance.
Since romance is so much a part of almost everyone's life, why are romances and mysteries too tend to be looked down upon?
Because people tend to think of them as formulaic.
Well, you know, it's got to be in a romance. It's boy meets girl or somebody meets somebody.
Exactly.
And then it leads to some kind of commitment or association.
Yeah. Well, and I also think in terms of romances, I don't know if it's true in mysteries, although the attitude is there about Westerns as well. You know, there's a formula. Boy meets girl. They fall in love. Something happens and breaks them apart. Then they get together by the end, and everything is happily ever after. In a Western, the formula is cowboy has tough life, meets villain, kills villain, rides off into the sunset. Maybe there's a romantic undertone. Maybe there's not, but he always leaves the girl behind, or almost always. In mysteries, whether the death is on scene or off, there's always, almost always, a dead body or some kind of mystery you have to solve. So you have amateur or professional sleuth runs into problem, which usually is a body, and tries to figure out who done it. And by the end, there's always the scene, or almost always the scene, of the unveiling where this is what you did and here's how you did it. And then that person either tries to run away, or like Perry Mason, they nail him on the stand, whatever it is. And then your happily ever after there is the bad guy gets justice.
Well, of course, you watch Perry Mason because you're expecting us. And, I watch Perry Mason a lot, and every once in a while there comes a, well, that's not really Perry Mason, right? Because it violates the formula. You're looking for the formula.
Yeah.
I pick up an Earl Stanley Gardner because I know what I'm going to get.
Well, yeah.
Are you a formula writer?
I write to I used archetypes when I create characters. I start there, is this person a librarian type? Is this person a scientist type? Or is this a bad boy? All of that kind of stuff. It gives you a starting place for your characters. And I do tend to follow the traditional arc of most of my characters are male, female, my romances. That's just happens to be what I write. But whether it's, male, male, female, female, it doesn't matter. Your characters, your protagonists meet one another. Maybe they don't like each other. Maybe they do. And then they've got to overcome something in order to get together. And the idea is at the end, they're together.
Well, that's what makes them so popular.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't want to wander into a book that's going to take you a place that you can't recognize, at least for the most part.
Yeah.
Unless you decide to swear off formula writing.
Right.
Mysteries are extraordinarily popular. And so are romances.
Yeah. And that's why Nicholas Sparks is absolutely correct when he says for the most part, he doesn't write romances. Because often one of his characters, I don't think I'm sending any spoilers here. People may have seen movies or read his books. One of the characters may pass away, and that person, then the other one has to live on beyond it. That does not happen in a romance. Mm-hmm. You don't have somebody, one of your characters, one of your protagonists die, your hero or heroine or your main people. That does not happen. There's a happily ever after that involves your people.
We have learned a lot from you today about publishing, about genres, and that you have produced some very spicy romances.
I have.
Well, I think you've got a market, kid.
Thank you.
Our guest today has been Francesca Hawley, author of Spicy Romances, and we'll get to some, I suppose you might say, more prosaic material after this pause. Ah, yes, the old typewriter goes on, and so do we. So, what's in the book bag this time?
Well, you remember Nan Carter, the contact person in San Francisco who sends me supplies of books from Arab writers and from African writers usually. But she has sent me nothing stranger than the book she sent last week.
I think it's strange that she writes to you at all. But
well, she calls. She doesn't write.
Stranger.
I get these books sent from all over the world. This is a book by an Israeli Arab, one of those groups of Arabs who are Israeli citizens living in Israel, but they're of Arab descent. His name is Emil Habibi, Habiby. And what makes it so interesting is that it's a novel, sort of. It turns out that Arabian literature never developed the novel as a literary form. It had a flourishing literature from the 6th to the 15th century, way before Western literature got started, and including famous things like Sinbad the Sailor or Arabian Nights.
Yeah, I've written, read a lot of tales and a lot of poetry.
A lot of poetry, but no novels. And so in the 20th century, when Arab writers, contemporary Arab writers, started getting interested in the Western form called the novel, it is interesting to see how they handle it and how they can incorporate it into their traditions. And this is a short book, but it is a screwy, screwy book. It's called The Secret Life of Saeed the Pessimist. He's half pessimist and half optimist. He is an Arab living in Israel. He's a klutz, a shlemiel. He becomes a member of the Knesset. He becomes a secret spy, but nothing that he does he do ever well at all. It's a picaresque comic novel, which also is not terribly Arabic in its inclinations, but poor Saeed constantly is getting into trouble. It's a combination, I would say, of the Arabian Nights, where Scheherazade tells a tale every day and then leaves it hanging until the next day so that she can stay alive, and Voltaire's Candide, which comes in for an interesting discussion in this very book. It's like Arabian Nights in that Saeed in each chapter has a short adventure in which ends up imprisoned, captured, lost, or something. And then you have to start the next chapter to find out how he gets out of that jam into the next jam, and hence all the way through the novel. So it's picaresque. There's no real plot, but it is an incredible portrait of what has to be just an unreal situation over in Palestine and Israel. Where, if you're an Arab and you live in Israel and are an Israeli citizen, do you fit? It's like our puzzlement with the Japanese that lived in Washington State during the war. Are they enemies? Are they our friends? Who are they? So we send them off to internment camps. Anyway, this is a series of incredible adventures that begin. The novel begins when Saeed, S-A-E-E-D, has been captured by aliens, and he's up in a spacecraft overlooking the Earth. He's been rescued, it turns out, from the top of a pole where he's been put by his enemies in the last chapter of the book, and so he's fortunate to have been rescued by the aliens. But given the safety of the alien spaceship, he's able to write to his friend and tell him about these adventures. And these adventures then are all letters back to his friend on Earth from his captivity in the spaceship. As I said, it's a crazy novel, but it gives you some sense of how weird it must be to not know exactly who you are or where you stand or what you ought to do.
It's amazing how novels have been altered. The structure of novels used to be fairly straightforward, but now it's thinking of Lincoln and the Bardo, and now this. It's just amazing. The form is changing along with the world.
It is changing inside out. Plot is disappearing.
Yeah.
Partly because plot is disappearing from the universe.
Quickly, the title before we go.
The Secret Life of Saeed the Pessimist.
Okay, that'll do it. We're pessimistic that you will be with us next week for another Scribble.